I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This episode is brought to you by Paramount Plus. Get in, loser! Mean Girls is now streaming on Paramount Plus. Join Katie Heron as she meets the plastics and Tina Fey's new twist on the modern classic. Get ready for more of the rumors, backstabbing, and jokes you loved from the original movie with some fetch surprises. Rated PG-13. Wear pink and head to ParamountPlus.com to try it free.
What's going on, everybody? Hope you are having a wonderful week so far. Podcast time. This week on the show is the one and only Anton Partridge. Anton, how I came across Anton, he owns a record label called Good Company and Get Together. Good Company is the label managers of All We Have Is Now, which is my record label. However, getting to know Anton over the years, he's worn many hats in the industry and been a huge influence of many records worldwide. He's signed some insane records, including Fisher Losing It, Medusa, Piece of My Heart, and some records from years ago. He's been in the industry a very long time and has a lot of experience of producing records, A&R in records, publishing on the records. So this podcast is a really interesting one. Great conversation. I loved it. So without further ado, Anton Partridge. What's cooking, man?
All is good, sir. All is very good. How about yourself?
Yeah, really good. The sun is shining in the UK. I'm happy.
I know, right? I mean, it's a rarity. And next week's a blazer.
Yeah, it's supposed to be a heat wave, right?
Yeah.
I'd
still rather be in Ibiza, but hotter than Ibiza.
Yeah, I feel like this podcast is always the most British start to any podcast because all I talk about is the weather every single episode.
But that's what we do. Anyway, it's been lovely doing the podcast. Thank you very much.
Oh, thanks for coming on. It means a lot, man. It means a lot.
Likewise.
How was IMS?
It was really good. It was, you know, just like Miami, as you well know with Miami, just great to see everyone again after 2 years of a hiatus. And it was lovely that it'd been moved to Destino because, well, it was lovely in one aspect that it'd been moved to Destino because it's a lot more contained, sorted the waifs and strays that normally just turn up with a laptop and a pair of headphones and follow you around for 4 days until you finally submit and listen to their dodgy demos. So there was less of that. You know, the downside is that the island opening early, I mean, I just got told that an hour ago, actually, because everyone had nightmares with taxis. It was ridiculous getting from anywhere to anywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, one crew left Amnesia on the Friday night, Saturday morning at 5 and got back to the hotel at 8:30.
Oh.
You know, it was that bad. I mean, there's 300 cabs on the island at the moment until May 15th when another 600 turn up. It was brilliant outside of transportation.
Because Uber is not there yet, is it?
No, Uber got kicked off the run off the island when they tried. No one's fucking around with that, like, taxi mafia.
Taxi mafia are brutal in Ibiza. I remember, like, how tough the police crack down on, like, illegal taxiing as well. And it's like, they're pretty rough.
Oh, there was one on the walk back from Amnesia. Someone was trying to offer anyone €500 just to drive them back. And they were like, no.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. I was about to go and rent a car and come back for them.
Well, it would have been cheaper. You could have made some money.
They need those electric bikes or scooters or whatever out there.
Could you imagine that? They'd be fucking carnage.
I know. It'd be hilarious, though.
I feel like there's an Instagram account that we're waiting to open for that. Like, that would just be...
I mean, if you're going from the old town to Bossa and stuff like that, those would be great, I reckon. Mm. If you're going up and on the motorway, it's like no chance.
The way the cab drivers drive over there as well with scooters.
Right, everyone drives over there. You know, let's not like just pick out the cab drivers.
Roundabouts, they still don't understand how to work roundabouts. And when, especially, this is not being disrespectful to the Italians, but in August, in Italian month, roundabouts are just carnage. Where
my very first time in Ibiza, having only just passed my driving test, and it wasn't my very first time, but the first time I was working there, which was 89, I was driving the head of the PR company I was working for to the hotel. We hired the car from the airport. I was going round the roundabout. I'm on the other side of the road, so that's daunting enough as it is. And there was a car just reversing back around the roundabout because it missed its turn in. Like, this shit's the Wild West.
Oh, I love it. I love that island. It's changed so much over the years, though, hasn't it, compared to what it used to be?
It has, but... But you know what? I try to detach myself from what I knew it was because as an experience, like for the GC crew,
yeah,
a lot of them, it was their first time out there and the island blew their minds.
Yeah.
And, you know, I kind of tried my best, even though it's quite difficult at times, not to be the old bastard going, oh, I remember when it didn't have roofs on these clubs. And, you know, it's like... And I remember when High was space. And High is actually great now. You know, it's an amazing club. But it's not space.
Yeah.
And if you knew space, then, of course, you're going to reminisce for that. But if you don't, it's like, fuck me, what a place.
No, it's definitely... They changed it massively. Is it sounding weird for you? Because there's something going on.
It's not sounding weird for me. You sound lush and deep and, you know, the long-lost love child of Barry White.
My lovely deep voice.
Yeah, man.
I don't know what's going on. I was there. My first experience, how old was I? I was 16 when I first went. So that was 2006. So it's changed a lot then. And even when I was living out there, it changed a lot massively. So I was out there when... I was working at Space when it was 24 hours on Sunday, and then the year after it changed to the 12 hour and they stopped the, like, there was like a curfew. And even that, like, everyone was like, oh, it's not as good as the good old days. It never is as good as the good old days, because that was when you were in your teenage years and you were having the best time of your life and you were doing whatever you weren't supposed to be doing. And that's what it's about. And everyone is still having...
I did shoot out slightly after you said... You were 18
in 2006.
2006, yeah. I'm like, okay, great. I was 16 in 86. Great. Fuck me. All right.
Yeah, it's pretty rough, isn't it? I didn't realize how much older you were, because you don't look that old, mate. You look great.
It's total, thank you, firstly, but it's total preservation of Airbus Sambuca. It seems to kind of like it's a preservative.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like inside I'm dying slowly or quite rapidly.
Have you ever had your liver checked?
Yeah. Do you know what? I am going for the full Monty checkup, because every year since being from about 45, I do that normal blood test, get everything checked.
Yeah.
Everything's always fine. And I'm like, do you know what? I need a deeper dive, because it can't be the way I've lived my lifestyle.
Have you had the finger up the arse yet?
I mean, that, what do you mean, weekly or
no,
yesterday?
No, just a check. Obviously, Ibiza, of course, it happened.
Yeah, always, you know.
Yeah, it's amazing that I can't remember who I was speaking to. Oh, yeah, I don't want to say his name, but I'll tell you after. But I was talking to him the other day. I've actually had him on the podcast, and he was like, I had a check, and my liver and kidneys are like practically not working, so I've had to give up alcohol. He's like, had to go completely teetotal because he's DJing parties really hard and always has done, but it's amazing.
Well, I kind of have to self-police because I don't know how, but I don't suffer from hangovers.
Really?
So I have to, yeah, and have never. And my wife didn't believe it when we first met. Yeah. And then she realized, oh, actually you don't, which is handy for her because I'll get up in the morning. Now I'll get up in the morning with the kids and I'll make some breakfast for everyone and do all that sort of thing. So she's like, oh, this is a Brucey bonus.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, and there is a term of being partridged because, you know, you go out, go hard, drink until whatever hour in the morning. And then I'll be up in the morning doing the work going, where is everyone?
Is it the fact you don't get hungover or you're stubborn as fuck and aren't willing to accept that you're hungover? Because my dad does that.
I don't, genuinely, honestly, don't feel shit.
Wow.
You know, the only thing that happens is I feel tired mid-afternoon.
Yeah.
And could easily, like an Ibiza taxi driver, go for a long siesta.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's it. I never feel shit in the morning. Some people have said it's because I'm pissed all the time, but, you know, I refute that.
Yeah.
It's just most of the time.
So what was your first time in Ibiza? What was it doing?
Well, outside of the... I went there twice with a neighbour and their families when it was like Fiesta Hotels in Bossa.
Yeah.
And actually, I was just reminiscing of the story with Nick Hawkes, who is the founder of XL. Well, not XL, that was Richard Russell, but they're doing the dance element of XL's Prodigy and everything like that, and then went on to form Positiva.
Yeah.
And I first met him... 87 or 88 at one of those holidays when it was non-dance related, and he was the resident DJ in the Jungle Bar, which was shots, drink games, a log over a swimming pool that you had to back, you know, it was all of that sort of thing. But he played all of the stuff that we loved at the time, whether or not it was, you know, back then the sort of soul fusion UK soul stuff of Loose Ends and Kim Mizell, British? I don't think so. But all of that then, and the soul to soul, and it's like, so we just gravitated towards that bar. And then the next year when I went back, no, that was 88, because then I dropped out of art college, and my first job in the industry was, in the music industry, was for a PR company called Lipsy Mead. Mm. And they did the PR for this thing called the Ibiza Music Festival, which was at Coup, and I mean, it was so random. It was like Norman Cook as Beats International, Pasadena's, Bridget Nielsen when she entered her recording career phase, you know, it was doing the PR for all that. So I took out, at the time, Smash Hits, Record Mirror, all of those people, and was like, oh my God, an experience, space, Pasha. And was like, and even then, I mean, we were fortunate enough to be on guest list because we were there on a press trip. But even then, I remember Pasha being something like 32, what worked out to be 32 quid to get into.
Yeah.
And that's like 89.
That's expensive.
And you're like, that was, yeah. I mean, as far as inflation goes, it's probably held its...
Nothing's changed. It's still fucking expensive. Yeah. What was
Pasha? They've not put the door prices up, but they have read the bar prices.
Yeah, Pasha must have been much smaller then as well. Well, all of the clubs must have been much smaller.
Yeah, but also bigger because there wasn't table service.
Yeah, true.
So with that whole thing in Pasha where it's like the amphitheatre, that was just people up there dancing. Yeah. And then the floor. Mm. And you walked in and it was just electric. Now that whole area is just 10, tables. 15, 20,000 pound tables.
Yeah. When did it change? When did the table service change? Can you remember?
Do you know what? I can't. I remember experiencing table service in the UK for the first time when a mate of mine shared a house with an actor that was really hot on TV.
Yeah.
And we went for a drink. We went to this club in Knightsbridge, and I remember picking up the menu, and there was a bottle of vodka for 250 quid, and I'm like,
your jaw dropping.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
And my mate actually, no, not even jesting, turned around and went, yeah, but don't worry, all the mixers are free.
That must, was that before the EDM kind of phase, or was that before?
Yeah. The EDM phase accelerated it.
Yeah.
Like nothing before. Everything became glam and glitzy, and the big names wanted to come in. And you know, it was Kathy Getter that really sort of was the hype, from what I saw on the island, of the table service thing, because the A-list celebs would turn up for Fuck Me, I'm Famous. And she was phenomenal in that VIP area. She would make everyone, even though they were already a star, feel like even more of a star in the evening. Work the tables. Here's a bottle on us. Do this sort of thing. And it was just, you know, that it wasn't just like, get in the corner, we're going to absolutely rob you, and, you know, we'll come when we're ready.
Yeah.
It was just proper VIP treatment.
Yeah.
And she just personified it
At the beginning of Fuck Me, I'm Famous, that night was really special on the island. I remember when it first started, and it was really special. It kind of changed into something, kind of changed into a bit of a beast towards the end of it, but it was you're right, it's definitely the part of in the island where it was like, look who I am, I'm at this party.
But you know, I didn't mind that. I mean,
no.
I love a big commercial tune as much as I love an underground record, right? So I didn't mind going and seeing like Sven at Cocoon.
Yeah.
While on the Monday night the Swedes were playing Pasha.
Yeah.
And it was just pure entertainment. And I mean, I used to do the Swedes on a Monday night, put my bag behind their merch desk, leave there at 6, pick up my bag, go straight to the airport, and then straight to work.
Mm.
You know, it was brilliantly. And like when you go and see Calvin at Shrya in 2019, when it was last open, and, you know, some amazing, like Nick Fanciulli's night, Dance or Die, was bloody brilliant. But then you see Calvin's night, and there isn't an inch to move, and there are people on people's shoulders, and it's just pure entertainment. Mm. You know, they're singing every word to every one of his records.
Yeah.
And you're like, do you know what? I love that. I love that. It's like, this is a different audience, but they're lapping up dance music.
Yeah. This is the thing in America where I find, when I first started touring in America, it's very different to the UK, where the crowds mix between them. So you would have like a Tiesto fan and you'd have like a Seth Troxler fan that were exactly the same person. And in the UK, you wouldn't necessarily get that so much. Maybe you wouldn't now, I don't know, but back then you wouldn't. But you're right, like what Calvin's done is pretty fucking amazing, isn't it?
It is. It's phenomenal. And especially now that, you know, he can just create a pseudonym and do whatever he wants.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the place that he's at. But it is, and it's, you know, it's always been tribal. You know, it got very silly for a while when subgenre after subgenre of a main genre was created, first and foremost, to sell records on Beatport and put them in a certain category. But then those people only followed that.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, no, I'm not going to deviate from what I love. You're like, well, the whole thing about music, so long as it doesn't matter if it's Nirvana, Aerosmith, or a dance record, if it's got a soulful element running through it, it doesn't have to be a soulful vocal, but it's there's something that connects to me. You know, the very industrial, whether or not it's heavy metal or even dance music, I struggle to connect with.
Yeah. That's interesting. So you're not into like the whole industrial techno kind of vibe?
I love going in for a brief moment.
Yeah.
You know, go in a couple of hours, but be there for 8 hours and, you know, no, I can't do that.
I agree. Like, just fucking give me a vocal. Give me a vocal occasionally. and I'm happy. Like, that's the thing for me, is like, give me something to latch onto, give me a melody or give me a vocal or something to be like, come on, we can take a break from the drums for a bit. And it's tough though, isn't it? Because when you're mixing different genres, when you're trying to do that in techno or other genres, it's hard to kind of fit anywhere.
Yeah.
Especially in this scene.
Yeah. I mean, the person that I saw on Friday, she doesn't quite go, you know, industrial heavy, but Tisha was amazing. Mm. You know, it was like this groove that got heavier, that got lighter, that was consistent, that, you know, something dirty would come over the top or a big piano line would come over. Mm. And, you know, it wasn't multi-format by any means, but it didn't feel like one lane.
Yeah.
And sticking to that lane entirely.
I think it's super important to do that. I think for me, like, as a DJ, that's so... You have to read the room and you have to see what actually needs to be played. Like, not, you don't always have to play the same thing.
No, but also the shortening of DJ sets plays into the hands of that, you know?
Yeah, totally.
You know, it's like, you know, the longer set you've got, the more of a journey you can go on. And, you know, growing up, whether or not it was the Haas.
Yeah.
God, what was it? Golden at Shelley's in Stoke with Sasha and, you know, the Orbital Raves around the M25. It was a huge mix of music in any one set at any one given time. But then even going to the opening early days at the Ministry when they didn't have a bar and it was Justin Burtman and Burtman and Burt Bevins.
Yeah.
That were the residents, and then Humphreys would come in and just do all night for 9 hours, and Knuckles would do the same, and Todd Terry playing 6 hours of nothing but his own records then, when he was just, you know, Todd is God, and still is, but it's like every record he put out was just a banger, and just playing that, and it was just a journey where, I always remember Morales, when he had the a cappella, he hadn't mixed it yet, but he had the a cappella for 10 City, My Piece of Heaven.
Mm.
And he just, off reel to reel, he just played the a cappella.
Mm.
He'd gone really heavy, really beat orientated, that red zone sound of the like squelchy noises, got really dark, and then just took it down and went into an a cappella for 2.5 minutes in the club with all the lights out. And it was
That's just amazing.
I mean, absolutely amazing.
Wow. Yeah, you don't really get that often nowadays, do you?
Yeah, I've got the time to.
Yeah.
Unless, you know, you're lucky. I was half tempted to try and catch Solomon all night at Pasha on Friday night, but it was a roadblock outside and it would have been even worse inside.
Yeah.
And like those moments where you get a DJ doing all night or, you know, a minimum of 3 hours. Really magical moments.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I agree. It's weird because realistically, do you think we need to stack the lineups as much as we do?
I can see why they do, because there's so much competition.
Totally, yeah, I totally agree, yeah.
And there's so much competition and, you know, if you don't and... Everyone's being very careful with their money, especially now.
Mm.
But if they think they're going to get more bang for their buck, whether or not it's a club or a festival, because there's more people and more choice to see, then they'll probably go for more choice.
Yeah.
Because everything I'm saying is just sort of reiterating the old bastard format of like, it's not the same as it used to be.
Totally.
And you know, it's that... Ideally, yeah, it would be lovely. But as a business, I don't think that it would be competitive if they had less people on at the festival and they were all playing even a minimum of 2 hour sets at a festival.
Yeah.
You know, let alone in a club. In a club, so long as you've got a hard ticket seller holding the headline, then, you know, if you've got that, you can afford to have slightly less on, you know, going that way. But there's billings are rammed and, you know, alphabetical billing is in my opinion, quite detrimental to the scene.
Yeah.
You know, it's pulling people through the door for numbers. You know, and I get it, and it's a risk if you turn around and go, right, well, as a club night, we're only going to have three DJs the whole night.
Yeah. There's something that's kind of attractive to me in that sense, though, where you have a 12-hour night and you have three DJs. Like,
it's amazing.
Do you think that takes it out of the promoter's hands? Like, it actually means that the promoters actually have to promote?
Well, I think, I don't know as much because to a certain extent, yes, but there's more onus on the DJs that are going to be at that night. It's like, that's a real telling point. What, you know, how many people can you pull through a door?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and, you know, the more DJs that are booked in the evening, both across the DJ and the promoter, the risk is slightly mitigated.
Yeah.
You know, if you've got just a handful of DJs and that it doesn't sell, of course, the DJs will say the promoter's shit and the promoter will be like, oh, you're not as big as you think you are.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah. It's tough, isn't it?
Yeah.
Fucking music business.
And it is. It's going to be interesting this summer. Look, the big stuff is going to fly. The sort of middle ground and the early adopters, I think, will find it tricky because there's, you know, money's harder, disposable income is harder and harder right now.
I agree with you, but I seem to be seeing people not working as much. Like the amount of jobs that are available in the UK and just can't find people to work. And then there's still people buying houses left, right, and center. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, but the people that are buying houses are the ones like, you know, it's, you've either already got a house and you've made a lot of money out of it, so you're just kind of moving, or your parents have got a lot of equity in the house, in their current house, and they're going to take that out and help you get on the ladder. You know, listen, if you look at a lot of the big events, they kind of all do this spread the price of the ticket out with Klarna. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is it Klarna or Karma? And like do these things, and even the ones where you book your ticket, which is a bit of a risky option, book your ticket for £1, you know, and pay the rest within 3 weeks of the event, and that's a real risky option because if you've only put £1 down, you know, cancelling 4 weeks out before the event isn't a problem.
It's scary, you know? Isn't it, as a promoter. Yeah.
And I was just reading something yesterday that spending on credit cards in the last year has gone up in the UK at least by 800%.
Yeah, I can quite believe that. It's weird because growing up in the UK, having a credit, like when you grew up, like when I was younger, like a credit card was not a thing. Now,
I made the mistake of falling sucker to the over-the-counter top man.
Yeah.
Why don't you get a store card?
Yeah.
And I'm like, yes.
And bought
loads of really dodgy clothes. And then, you know, it's like, fuck, how am I paying this back? And how long is it going to take? Because every time I pay something back, it still seems to go up.
Yeah.
You know? And it was like, and my mum had always, up to that point, not even, she'd always instilled in me, if you haven't got the money for it, we don't get it.
Don't buy it, right?
Yeah, don't buy it. You know, there were TVs on HP and all of that sort of thing. She's like, when we got the money, we'll buy the TV.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, totally. We're not going to, like, we never had a credit card and all that stuff. Mm. In fact, I only really got a credit card about 6 or 7 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and that was for the business.
Yeah.
And then I got my own, because it was like, oh, I can get air miles on this and I can get companion vouchers I can look at this one. But you've got to be like really diligent and disciplined with it where you're like, I'm going to pay this off. Use it as a debit card. I'm going to pay this off every month.
Yeah, because my first time going when I got a credit card was America, because you can't do anything in America without credit. Like you can't get a phone contract. You can't get a car. You can't get a mortgage. You can't do anything. So I kind of, that was my, America was my first time getting a credit card. And yeah, it's, you don't want to get caught with them. They're dangerous.
I know, man. No.
How,
believe me. Yeah.
I want to talk about a little bit about what you do. Obviously I know what you do, but I don't know how it started. So let's go back to the beginning.
I'll have to give you a very abridged version because it's been a long time.
And yeah.
There's lots of different things. So art, I was at art college and music was always a passion, but it was probably second to art. You know, I was doing graphic design and illustration. Oh, cool. Fortunate enough back then that it was a grant, not a loan. Mm. But the grant that you got was the same if you did art to something that didn't require a lot of materials.
Yeah.
So I was working every night in Safeways and every weekend in Safeways. And after 2 years, it was like burnt out. Mm. I was like, I'm not going to pass this.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I'm not, I haven't got the energy to have the creative thought process to really push through on this. Mm. And dropped out and went for my second love, which was music. No one initially hired was looking for music with anybody with any experience. Got a job at the Institute of Directors, which was this big place on Pall Mall that basically lobbies the government on behalf of businesses. But the best thing about that was I was in PR. The best thing about that was I had an amazing boss called Gordon Leake, and he was the ex-editor of the Sunday Express.
Mm.
And he was one of those guys that gave you loads of pearls of wisdom. Careful how you are with people on the way up, because you never know who you're going to meet on the way down.
Yeah.
All of those sorts of life, you know, enriching like nuggets. And then I joined Lipsy Mead, which was the independent press agency that did, they did Queen and The Associates and all that sort of thing. And then I came in and did a load of what was considered dance stuff to a point there. Heatwave, Justin Brown. Mm. I'm guilty of saying FAB featuring MC Parker.
Yeah.
Which was a novelty dance record. And yeah, I loved that though, because I was like making up these press releases saying Parker, after the Thunderbirds came off TV, moved to New York and hooked up with Afrika Bambaataa and you know, all this sort of thing.
Amazing.
And like we had a whale of a time with it. But all the time whilst I was at that independent PR place, I desperately wanted to be in a major. The most ideal place for me, because I loved what they did, was FFRR and what Tongi was doing.
Mm.
And, you know, I don't know how I initially met. I made contact with Billy McLeod, the promotions director, and nothing was there, but he said, keep in touch. And I just kept on going back in to the point where I befriended the security guard. I turned up one morning at 6 a.m. with a balloon company. We filled his office full of blue and white balloons that said, give us a job, because he's Glasgow Rangers. So he could only open his door like 4 inches, and he had to start popping the balloons like that, these sort of things. And then, of course, with the art background, had these vast bits of brown paper that I folded up to look as if they were a 12-inch record and sent to Roger Ames, Tongi, Billy. And when they finally opened it up and said, but like, why are you snoozing? You've got to give Anton a job, you know, all this sort of thing. So, and nothing came up there, but when...
So none of those worked.
None of it worked directly for them, right? But when a job came up at MCA for a plugger, I mean, it's probably to get me off his back. Billy McLeod was like, you've got to interview this guy.
Yeah.
And because I was like... It's amazing back then, because I can't imagine this happening now, because I knew I wanted to be a plugger. I loved radio. I loved all forms of it, you know, listening to BFBS and, you know, Kiss, and when it was a pirate, and LWR and all that sort of thing. It was like, I called up everyone at Radio 1. I've managed to get every producer from the daytime shows, somehow get the numbers, called them up going, look, I want to be a plugger. I want to go into promotions. Is it possible to come in and sit with you and see what you do? And I'm sure this will help me when I finally get an interview. Everyone said yes.
Yeah.
I mean, from breakfast show producer to the nighttime, the head of Capital said yes. So when I finally went for this gig at at MCA, and they were like, do you know what the job is? And I was like, yeah, I've spoken to Mike Childs, I've spoken to these people, and they're like, what are you talking about? You know, we just about get calls with them. I'm like, I know, right? I've been in there, I've sat in on the shows, I've done this. That's sort amazing. Of thing. So, you know, got the gig at MCA, did radio promotions for 6.5 years, did A&R for another 2.5. And it was at that point.
I want to cut you in there just for people that don't know what plug-in means and A&R means.
Right. So radio plugging is the industry term for radio promotions or TV promotions. I was radio promotions, so I dealt with Capital, KISS, because it had been legalized, Radio One, you know, and you sort of start as an assistant and work your way through the ranks there. And whilst being a radio plugger, I would like give all the producers tips of what I thought, even non-dance records, tips of what I thought were the records that were hot. These are the three that you need to be listening to. This is this and that. Especially when Joe Wiley was doing the evening session on Radio 1, I didn't have the audacity to do it with Pete, because I'm like, well, I'm going to teach him to suck eggs. He's, you know.
He's Pete.
But with people like Joe Wiley that did the evening session Radio 1, her producer then, Christine Ball, you know, I just, and they wouldn't be MCA records. They'd be whatever. If there was a hot MCA record, fine, that's in the mix. But it was just what was great that was out there. And then had this reputation. And then there was actually Mark Goodyear on Drive Time introduced a half an hour DJ mix at the end of his show between 4:30 and 5:30 every weekday.
What station was that on?
Radio 1.
Yeah.
And I did the mix every day, and, you know, would that really sort of, all of the time I was DJing out and doing parties and I was warming up for Oakenfold at the Limelight and doing stuff like that. But I was at home the night before, sort of on turntables, vinyl, recording live to that, trying to get it as tight as possible for, you know, it was half an hour feels a bit long for that. It might have been 20 minutes. You know, trying to get as many records as I could in and deliver that in the morning for Fergus Dudley, Mark's producer, to then broadcast that evening. And so I was getting tons of records. Everyone was just sending me records for that because, you know, it was a huge show.
Yeah.
It wasn't signed to Friday nights and Tong. It was a much bigger audience. So I was getting tons of records, and then I'd started going to the A&R guys. You should be, what are you doing with this? Like, you should be chasing this and chasing that. And then went up to A&R, which is ultimately finding artists, records, songs, producers that are deemed worthy of signing, and try whether or not it's a one-off, long-term prospect of ultimately a major, making money out of the situation. And I was there for 3.5. I did A&R for 3.5 years, and it was a very expensive time for dance records. It was in a boom. And I kind of wanted to go against the grain a bit. And I was like, right, these are all great producers. I'm going to go and make records with them. And made records and came back to MCA saying, right, I want to sign these 5 records for 1,500 quid a piece. And because they're so used to records costing 50 or 100 grand, they were like, we don't want to waste our time on these. I was like, well, if you don't want these, you kind of don't want what I am doing and what I want to do. And paid me out for 6 months, and I went off and set up, wasn't even a label, it was just management. And so I used all my radio experience of like, right, I'm going to get these on the radio, you know. And I kept 3 of them, 2 the artists wanted to go away with, but all 3 were top 10 records.
What artists were these? What records were these?
Emmy More Than This, which was number 2, signed with Luke at Manifesto. Lucid, Can't Help Myself, and subsequent singles signed with Tommy at FFRR. And Matthew Roberts, a Wicked Scouse producer. He had a pseudonym, Mighty High Revival, I think, or Mighty High 3000.
Yeah.
I think it was. and signed that to Polydor, you know, and all were hits. And at a time when people were paying stupid money for records that were already set up. So it really put me in a great position. And then dance hit the doldrums, you know. And so with some of those producers, we were making pop records for people like S Club 7. Keeping the business going like that. And then, just trying to remember what the next step was. Oh, and then started consulting for Sony, ATV, music publishing. And again, you know, first record was Lola Steam.
Wow. Shapeshifters.
Shapeshifters, which was a 600 quid record. It was just like, you know, it was like, okay, so.
And how much? That must have made some fucking money.
It kind of did, unfortunately. And I totally agree with Simon from Shape's opinion at the time, where I was like, if you change a note on that string, right, we'll have all the publishing.
Yeah.
But it had already gone out as a bootleg. And it's like, I don't want to touch it. So there was, it did make a lot of money, but it could, it made a lot of money for the original writers, Anthony White and, it will come to me at some point. And, you know, but it was a number one record.
Yeah, it was great. You know?
And it was just brilliant. And then,
what year was that?
Oh, it's almost 20 years ago.
It's got to be, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's almost 20 years ago. And then had.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
But I've been involved with Wiley so many times. I'm trying to remember what would you do? The record that you sampled. I had the publishing on that, and that was number two. And I had a great run and signed We Are the People. Empire of the Sun.
Oh, okay.
Empire of the Sun, you know, started sort of diversifying in that sort of thing. And so Australia was coming through big time with music then. Midnight Juggernauts, Empire of the Sun, Sneaky Sound System.
Yeah.
You know, it was like picking up some of these really big dance pop projects. And then
want to go into that publishing. What's publishing?
Publishing. So you've got masters, which is records, and publishing, which is who wrote the record, who was the writer, not necessarily the performer. So if you're looking at it from a pop context, someone like S Club 7 that I mentioned earlier, right? They were the vehicle, and you'd have production teams making the music and top liners who essentially are the people that write the lyrics and the melody that go with the lyrics. And that side of things, anyone that wrote the music, lyrics or melody, there's a portion of that sale goes to the publisher. And when you get played on the radio, PRS, it's a Performance Collection Society, every time the radio plays a record, it pays out.
Yep.
And that goes to PRS. So, you know, it's sometimes the people that wrote the record have got nothing to do with anyone that's performing on the record at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then other times, you know, like yourself, like other people, you know, you write things, you get help in from people, you've got songwriters, you know, so it's a combination of forces that make that work.
Yeah.
And so the Sony public, and America, the EDM thing hadn't happened in America, and everything that I was doing with dance, like Sony in America, just nah. And then over a period of time, I started getting more emails going, really like this, what's this about? I'm like, I think they're going to get this. You know, so went over just before EDM really kicked off. And the idea was for me to be there 6 months. I was there New York three weeks of the month, London 1 week, sort of dotting between the New York and London office. And then ended up being in New York for 3 years. Mm. And it was an amazing experience. It was just
eye-opening.
How vast it is. Yeah. And just, you know, I remember someone talking to me, there's a really good girl. She's great. She's got this, you know, this girl, she's like a real techno girl. And I'm thinking, fuck, they're talking about techno and this is amazing. And actually what they were talking about was Lady Gaga.
Okay. You know, interesting.
Their definition of what she was doing early days, because it synthesized and like fall to the floor pounding. Yeah. They're like, that's techno, before the term EDM had been, you know, invented.
Yeah.
And whilst I was out there, Christian Tattersfield, who was the CEO of Warners, kept on sort of bugging me to come and do a label at Warners. And I just kept on knocking it back, going, you haven't done dance music for 14 years. You haven't got the right people in Europe.
Yeah.
You haven't done a contract that is anything less than 5 albums.
Yeah.
I'm all right, thanks. I'm here. And then he, being the sort of entrepreneur that he was like, form a label, we'll deal with the label. The label can then dictate the terms and do the deal terms with however you want to do it, the artist. So came back from New York to set up one more tune within Warners. And for the first year, it was actually, despite everything that he had said, whenever I put a deal memo together to send out a contract to an artist, and if it had one option for a single, it still had to go before Leo Cohen, who was the worldwide CEO. Mm. And Leo would be like, what the fuck's this? Where's the 5 albums? Fuck off. And, you know, it was a year of going backwards and forwards, arguing with Leo. And it was only until I sort of put it in the vernacular, in his old hip-hop sense of what he was doing back in the day, picking up one-off hip-hop records.
Yeah.
That it was sort of like slightly tweaked with it. And then it was game on. And then I ended up having to sort of do the same thing with setting up the revitalization of Big Beat. Mm. Again, the whole contracting process, finding the right people to work the records for them in America. And it's just a great experience. And I did that for 8 years, had some fantastic success, and then was booted out with a year left on my contract after my best financial year ever.
Yeah.
Much to my surprise, I thought, all right, I've, you know, got one more year. I only said I was going to do it for 3 years and had been there for 8. I was like, I really want to do my own thing. And I had started Good Company whilst I was at Warners as a sort of feeder label to go through ADA.
Yeah.
But I realized quite quickly I didn't have the bandwidth to do A&R for Warners A&R for the, you know, Good Company, the feeder thing. And so I stopped that. So when I was fortunate enough that when it came to the end of my time, I had made the Medusa Piece of Your Heart record with the guys in the Warner studio. Mm. And the worst thing that could have happened was that Warner signed it and then got rid of me.
Yeah.
But they just didn't want to know. And I don't blame them to a certain extent, because dance was in the doldrums. It was being totally asphyxiated by grime, hip hop, everything. You know, it wasn't as it was, and it isn't as it is currently now. Mm. You know, and they're like, you know what? I just can't see the business in your genre.
Yeah.
Unbeknown to me and them, that year, the genre would come back with a force. And the two records that I was very fortunate to start with was Medusa's Piece of Your Heart and Fisher's Losing It.
Yeah.
And you know, it was a real kind of roll of the dice, in the sense that the day I got told my contract wasn't being renewed, I just exchanged on a house.
Mm.
I had an 8-month-old kid, and I was fortunate enough to have some offers from other labels.
Yeah.
And I sat down with my wife and I'm like, look, we've got these, we'll be all right financially, but I've always really wanted to do this. But it means we're going to initially earn a lot less than we've been used to.
Yeah.
She was brilliant. She was fantastic. She was like, right, let's sit down. Let's get a spreadsheet together. What are our costs? What do we need to survive?
Yeah.
You know, was working and still is working, you know, between the two of us. I was like, okay, yeah, do you know what? We got this. We can cover this. We're going to go on holiday to Margate and not get a plane for a while and do that sort of thing. And the other thing that, funnily enough, galvanized me to do it was having an 8-month-old kid.
Yeah.
Whereas ordinarily you should think, oh, fuck, I've got to provide. I've got to do this. I'm going to take the money. You know, I know I want to do my independent thing, but I'm going to take the money. It was that he was 8 months.
Yeah.
And it was the cheapest he's ever going to be.
Yeah.
There's no iPhones. There's no Air Max. You know, there's nothing. And it's like, okay, this is the point of which we can earn a lot less.
Yeah.
And
at the point where you actually have to make it work. So you've got a time period to be like, fuck it. We've got 5 years until to make it work.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, absolutely. And it's like, all right, you know, knuckle it down. It was me on my own. Then.
So going back to Peace of My Heart, did you sign that to Good Company or did you sign that to Warner?
No. It was via Good Company to. And then what happened was that it was June and I put the record, I gave the record out to a few people. Jam was one of the first people to play it. Right,
Mr. Jam, for anybody listening.
Yeah, Mr. Jam on Radio 1 at the time. And it got a load of interest. But I hadn't got a distribution deal. I got artwork because of having previously set up a company. I hadn't got a distribution deal. I hadn't got anything. I sat down with, you know, management and stuff like that. It's like, they were like, we want to strike whilst the iron's hot. I'm like, I get it. So we licensed it onto Polydor. He did an amazing job with it, you know, really did. But it was even with that record, right? It was a worry because when it first got played, June or July, it kind of people loved it, but it didn't react on the metrics that lots of labels judged, records, Shazam, all of that sort of thing. But people still loved it and would like went in for it. And it was a joint thing. Actually, it was a joint thing between Polydor and Universal Germany with Arena over there. It was like totally gung-ho. When it came to releasing it, right, for the first 4 weeks, bugger all happened.
Really?
Like nothing. We've released it, I think it was February perhaps. And nothing happened. Like Apple went for it, great. Spotify were indifferent, you know. Jam was playing it, minimal Shazam reaction. And then it's like, how the fuck do we turn this around? And then Sarah Beaumont put it in on Party Anthems.
Yeah.
And I think it kind of broke Shazam records.
Really?
For Shazam's on that show. It was like, it went from zero, it went from about 189 in Shazam.
Yeah.
4 weeks in, got that Party Anthems play and was at 12.
Wow.
And woke the whole of the industry up.
Yeah.
And then from there, because we always thought the reason why we're doing a joint deal with Germany and the UK, we thought it'll probably sort of permeate in Europe and come into the UK.
Yeah.
But it just flew. And then the rest of the world caught up with it, you know.
It's a crazy record. It's such a good record.
And do you know what? It's funny. It's like 3 years later, it's still the template that you hear for so many pop dance records. You know, a melancholic vocal, an extended note bass line coming in on something a bit deeper, a bit darker. It's still that, you know, even to the point where it's like, oh, come on, we've got to try and break this formula. We've got to try and break the Medusa formula.
Yeah, but that's the thing with, well, you'll be the first person to kind of say this, but it's the thing with commercial music, right? If a formula works, why break it?
I don't disagree with that at all. And it's... it's a worry, right? Mm-hmm. Because still everything has got a, in the commercial lane, a da na 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 ba da la la type hook ad lib thing after it. And that's when genres start eating themselves.
Yeah.
That's when innovation doesn't cut through in a pop sense. And yeah. And normally where the pop world leads, they take the things that they hear to the left of the center and mold them or fuse them into, you know, something that becomes. Madonna was always brilliant at that.
Yeah.
You know, she'd make amazing pop records and go and choose the hottest from Jelly Bean Benitez to Marway.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, just keep pushing the boundary of what is a pop record.
Do you think you can do that in electronic pop music though? Do you think, when was the last time that for you that dance music was pushed forward in the pop side of the industry?
Honestly, and not because I'm so associated with it, but it was Medusa.
Okay, right? Before
at that point,
but before Medusa, but before Medusa, like,
well, there was the sort of the EDM phase was pushing it forward. It suddenly became dance music for stadiums, as opposed to nightclubs, But there are countless things that aren't necessarily dance artists that you hear other artists doing. And even now, like Pink Panthers.
Yeah.
Like it's pushing boundaries forward.
Yeah. And
okay, it's not four to the floor dance music, and she's leaning heavily on the amazing garage years, but reinventing that sound. And it's like what's happening in drum and bass at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole new breed of drum and bass producers that aren't sticking to the template of what is traditionally a drum and bass record.
Yeah.
And they're taking influences from trap, hip hop, drum and bass. I don't want to say happy hardcore, but you know,
well, it is. There's some like hardcore influences in there, 100%.
You know, there's all of the, there's like, you know, and it's actually permeating across Europe, you know. I mean, look, the Love It or Lose It, the Lude record that sampled Men at Work, number one in Germany for 3 weeks.
It's killing. Yeah, yeah.
I couldn't tell you. I don't even know if it has ever happened that there's been a drum and bass record that's been number one in Germany ever.
No.
And you see these records from Vibe Chemistry and Alchemist and these whole new breed that are popping in Austria and Denmark and, you know, Eastern Europe.
Yeah.
And it's because it's not just the traditional format in what we know as a country owning drum and bass coming from the hardcore Wednesday nights at Heaven, you know, and it being morphed into, you know, it's a different thing now.
Well, the last commercial drum and bass guys that we had was like Chasing Status, Rudimental, and they, again, it was amazing what they did, but they had a formula to that. Yeah. And now it seems to be, it's changing a little bit. Also, it's kind of going back to what we've spoke about many of times. It's just different generations. And
it is.
And especially now after COVID, like how generations have changed on their listening patterns and how they listen to music and how they consume music. It's so different.
Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's too easy to kind of get pious about an old record being sampled that was only 5 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, it's blatantly obvious, especially with the advent of TikTok, that kids don't know records from 2 years ago.
Yeah.
Let alone us being precious about, well, you can't sample that, or you can't do that, because that's only 5 years ago. It's like...
Yeah, we all sound like fucking old people, really.
Yeah.
Like, the amount of times I've bitched to friends and to you lot and everything, being like, oh my God, they sampled that. Like, how? But I guess my question to you in that situation, is there longevity as an artist for that? Do you feel, as a label point of view?
No, I'll stick my neck out on this one, which, you know, is obviously open, is quite subjective and open to debate.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
But I don't think there is. You kind of like, it's the difference between fast food and a degustation menu.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like those sort of things that are formulaic. And listen, every time I hear another M1 bass organ, I'm like, this can't work anymore, can it?
Yeah.
And then something just crushes the charts with it. And you're like,
it worked.
Well, hold on.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, or an M1 piano or a Donk bass line. Mm. And in that commercial world, and you're like, no, it can, you know, and dance, I think, came back from the doldrums, as to my point, from it kicking back in and almost 3 years ago, if not 3 years ago, because it's amazing what 3 to 5 years can do for a generation in music.
Amazing.
Where it was so consumed, you know, like black music consumed everything culturally, sound. Yeah. It was amazing what it did. You know, and then those kids that were listening to that who had never heard a dance record were suddenly like hearing some dance music, and like it was fresh to them.
Yeah.
Whereas the generation previous, they were like tired of it. They're like, I'm hearing the same old shit. Mm. It's not reinventing itself. This really exciting thing over here. But from an artist prospect, to go back to your point, I think it's very difficult to kind of have a template of what could be commercially successful.
Yeah.
There's only a handful of people that are doing it. Joel Corey's crushing it from a commercial point of view, mm-hmm. and he's a brilliant, enigmatic person.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, there's an artist prospect in there long term.
And he works so hard. Like that dude works so hard.
And he's the loveliest man in showbiz, second to myself. You know, but it's like, Jax Jones is the same, you know.
Tim,
got a formula.
Yeah, Jax is also, like, I remember working on Breathe with Jax, and he taught me the whole, you know what you were saying, like the hook and then la-di-da-di-da-di-da afterwards. Yeah. Like, he was the one that taught me about that, and I always just looked at it, was like, oh, this fucking annoying part in the record that I can't stand but everyone sings along to. And
or why haven't they finished the lyrics on that?
Exactly. Stop being lazy.
Yeah,
write a fucking good lyric. And then he was like, no, it's the international language. He's like, you can go to Hong Kong and no one speak a single word of English and they all can sing along to that part of the record. They don't know what the fuck you're saying beforehand, but they can all sing along to that. And I'm like, that's when it clicked for me. I was like, wow, that's 100% true. And he's been the master of that for the last 8 years.
Yeah, well, like going back to Medusa, it's like Joris Vaughan did an amazing remix on it. I remember Nick Fanciulli at Esquire finishing on Joris's mix of it.
Yeah.
And the whole crowd just da da da.
Yeah.
Da da. You're like, fuck.
Yeah. Calvin was the first person. Well, no, actually, looking back at it, for me, and this is just because of, like, the generation I grew up in, Faithless, Insomnia, or God is a DJ, those were the first times where you would go see somebody and then leaving the festival or leaving the show, everyone's like just humming. Yeah. And then Calvin did it as well.
Yeah. But you know what the mad thing is? It's like with Faithless, Insomnia wasn't a hit first time round. No. It had to go and be a hit in Germany.
Yeah.
And come back to the UK.
It's mental.
Everyone parred it.
Yeah.
Everyone absolutely parred it. They were like, not bothered.
It's mad.
You know, and then it's just a huge, huge number one. Yeah. I had that back in at MCA with Living Joy, Dreamer.
Yeah, wow. Such a tune.
First time round, you know, picked up that record, first time round. I think we got to, at best, 39, like that. And then it was, I always remember, it was a year or so down the line, and Nick Raphael, who was and still is a big wig in the game, you know, was big at FFR Records or London Records, sorry, and president of Capitol Records. And he, at that time, worked in a sandwich bar that his dad owned around the corner from MCA, but ran Vague in Leeds.
Okay.
This legendary nightclub, you know. Mm. And every time we go in there, he was like, you've got to put that record back out, you know. Was he was like, it's our anthem. And he would say this for about 9 months,
yeah.
So like a year. And then a year later, it just came back. It was actually Rollo and Rollo Armstrong's Faithless that did the remix on it, that galvanized it to have something fresh about it. But the original was just like, okay. And then it was like huge number one.
So it's interesting that what I guess that's the thing, coming from a label owner, comparing it from back then to now, it for me it feels very similar, where you have to create hype of a record. But what's your experiences nowadays of having to create hype on the record, and how long do you wait for it to actually release it?
It's weird because hype is created in so many different lanes at the moment. You know, there's the hype on TikTok because it's suddenly been a challenge. Mm. There's the hype on Instagram because loads of people are asking what the track ID is on someone playing something. Roberto Cerracci Joins was a big one. That was an Instagram record. It was like,
that was an expensive one.
I remember being there that night, and the reaction on that video looks like the crowd, and the crowd went ballistic. Mm. But it's only because there wasn't a vocal for 2 hours prior to that. And then that came in, and it was like, off, you know. So there's so many. I mean, one of the things that I still think is detrimental to dance music is on air, on sale.
Mm.
You know, everything. If you're an indie, you're kind of not as beholden to that.
Yeah.
You know, you can promo something out early days, you can do all that sort of thing. If you're at a major, you have to be very beholden to those rules because there are set guidelines. You know, everybody wants equality as to when they're going to get the record.
Yeah.
But for dance music, it's like what it meant early days was, right, so you start your club promo the same time you go to radio, that you go to DSPs and Spotify and Apple. And then if radio loved it, they'd get on it early, and DSPs might like it. But genuinely, you know, dance music needs context.
Yeah, totally.
And it needs that. The ones that really work, whether or not they're, pardon me, the more commercial ones or the cooler records, are the ones that people can refer to. Do you remember that night we were out?
Mm.
Oh, what a great night. And that was that tune. You know, that was that tune. If the first time they hear it is on Spotify or Apple or whatever their choice of platform is, or the radio, it doesn't have any context.
Yeah, yeah.
It's and it's not, it's the context and the attachment to that context which will keep them coming back to that record to relive that moment.
Yep.
You know, totally. And that's when you've got a winner. You know, that's that perfect combination, because there are so many factors which decide the success commercially of a record or not. And those factors all need to sort of align up within, not exactly at the same time, but with fairly close proximity to one another.
Yeah.
If they're too far apart, it's, you know, you can have the best records in the world, but if those things kind of are too far apart, it just misses its opportunity. And this, especially now, there's so much more music. There's something brand new that comes in shiny and does it, you know, and takes people's attention away. It's not to say that something can't come out and a year later it's a hit without the aid of TikTok or any other kind of social platform, but you know, it's harder than it was in the past. But you know, TikTok is, on one hand, it's an amazing thing, on the other hand, it's the absolute devil, because it can propel you to being, or your record to being, a global phenomenon and then just disappear. But then at the same time, everybody wants to know what your TikTok plan is.
Yeah.
And unless it starts really organically and naturally, doesn't matter how much money you pump into it, it's not going to happen. You can pump money in to amplify something that is happening, but trying to get that spark, you could bankrupt yourself trying to get that spark.
Totally.
And it wouldn't happen.
So how much would you say releasing a record is, on a percentage, quality of record and then just pure luck?
It's always got to be quality.
Yeah.
It's always, you know what, it's something that whether or not it's Warner's or Good Company, you know, I'm just always trying to instill into any A&R man, anything to do with that, because, you know what, if you put a quality record out and it's not a hit initially, it's got every chance of being a hit later down the line if something happens and it's a sync or it's, you know, someone grabs onto it. If it's a shit record, it always remains a shit record and people won't want to know.
Yeah.
Totally. You know? So, you know, music is the most important thing first and foremost. And to be really proud of what you do, regardless of whether it's 50,000 streams or 500 million streams, it's like, you know what? There's nothing about this that, I don't know if embarrassment is the right word, but there's nothing about this that I feel regret about. As a producer, I know what it's probably like where you're like, you'll listen back to records and go, could have done that better, or I wouldn't have done that there, or I would have changed the hi-hats here. Mm. But that's always your development as a producer.
Yeah,
you know,
if
you're 100% happy with even the biggest hit, so your progress stops.
Well, there's also so many people that we all know that have hit records that actually can't stand the hit records because they've had to play it so many times, and it might be a great record to somebody else, but to them it's a fucking shit record because it's just does their head in so much every time they hear it. What when you say, like, I want to, like, as a label owner, when you're, how do you guys reflect as a label when you're like, okay, we should have done this better, or we could have done that better, or is it every time is pretty much very similar and a lot of the processes are like, let's just hope?
There's a kind of multitude of things, because, you know, I'm a frustrated closet producer. There's one element where I'm listening back to records going, do you know what? My gut was saying I should have done this with it. Mm. And it should have sounded a bit more like this. Fuck it. I should, to that. And in another way, timing is everything.
Yeah.
And the only things that you look back in hindsight are with really, did we put this out at the right time?
Yeah.
You know, were there too many other records sort of on its tail that sounded a bit like it, or you know, was it something out on its own, or were there just too many records around and it didn't have a chance to breathe and got sunk without trace? I'm just trying to think back over. Listen, when I was initially at MCA, I signed £1 Fishman, right? The fact that I managed to keep my job every day after that was a bonus, right? I signed £1 Fishman and kept my job for another 5 years, right? It was like, but that came from somewhere.
Yeah.
And it was an a cappella, and the black music crew were all just putting the a cappella over the beats. And I'm like, there's an opportunity here.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, let's have a bit of fun. And again, it's this thing that happens in dance music where, like, I'm going to have a bit of fun. Gave the guy a bit of money, produced it up, had notoriety. There was this whole thing about, like, how he's deported, but his visa actually ran out anyway on the December 31st. So he's always going back to Pakistan. He'd been here 3 years, right? But he went back to Pakistan being the face of Vodafone, getting all of these ambassadorial contracts, and sent me messages of, like, the house. He came to England to make money to send back to his wife and children. And then he's starting to show me, like, the house that he's in and, like, palatial thing. And it's like, fuck, do you know what? There's a real difference that has been made to that person's life over what initially for me was a bit of fun.
Yeah. I can't believe you know the £1 fish guy.
Yeah. Listen, I had everybody hitting me up for voicemail messages for it. So it'd be like, everyone were like, you've got to get him to do me a voicemail message. You know,
and he'd make a fortune on Cameo. He needs to get on there.
He could have made an absolute bomb doing those.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was on there the other day. Carol Baskin's on there.
Genius.
I know. Okay, so what do you guys class as a success as a record when you release a record? Because it's very easy. Well, it's not actually easy. That's an absolute bullshit. Like, let's say, for instance, for us, like, when we're releasing on All We Have Is Now, for anybody listening, Good Company runs All We Have Is Now. So we license the records to Good Company, and the Good Company team manage the record label for us. But success is such a strange word when it comes to records, or when it comes to life generally, but I still don't know. Like, myself and Ryan set goals on the records at the beginning of, before we even spoke to you about working with the record label. And we set goals on what we wanted the streams to be, who we wanted to be playing, how many radio spins we wanted to do, and things like that. When we hit those goals, technically that's a successful record. When we go past those goals, it's even more of a success. When we don't reach those goals, it's not a success. That's kind of
my success barometer isn't based solely on streams, because that, like, you know, the whole idea of when I set up Good Company was for it to be a thriving business that could be financially successful without having hits, and that the hits were the icing on the cake.
Totally.
Because the pure hits business is for the majors.
Yeah.
You know, they have very deep pockets. They have a huge back catalogue to absorb any losses and that sort of thing. But it's like, you know, what a large part of reinventing my headspace was is celebrating the small wins, mm-hmm. you know, and whether or not that was, you know, critical acclaim, notoriety, and then streaming success.
Yeah.
You know, there's a different kind of, you know, on our, because we have Good Company and we have a sister label, which is Unashamed Commercial Dance, called Get Together.
Yeah.
You know, we have a young kid, never existed before, called Rules, and just a beautiful, lovely record. It was really, like, didn't sound like anything else out there.
Mm.
You know, like, all right, we had to create a profile on Spotify. We had to do all these sort of things. You know, we got him on French radio. We got loads. And, you know, he's what? I know by comparison to big chart successes, it's a long way off. But he's on close to 20 million stream now. And you're like, really proud of that.
Yeah, you massively, know? Yeah.
From zero to that point is, especially when you read some of the stats, it's a real successful job in that sense.
Mm.
When you read some of the stats of, you know, and of course it's a ratio because of how much music has been put into Spotify and DSPs, but the percentage of things that don't even get beyond 100,000 streams.
Yeah.
You know, it's 8% that are above 100,000 streams.
Oh, really?
And 8%.
Shit. I didn't even think of that.
And so, and then when you try and kind of go, okay, so what's the percentage when it's a million plus?
Mm.
And it's like 4 point something.
Wow.
And you're like, okay, well, we're in this category that consistently does that.
Yeah.
And punches above that and has really big commercial moments. So, but then there's, you know, if you're making some cooler music, it's like, what's the success? Has this opened more doors for me to play somewhere?
Yeah.
Has this introduce me into another market?
But I guess I'm more so questioning that as a label, so, because like for me, like I just think releasing music is a success for an artist generally. It helps you, unless it's a shit record, it generally will take you a step further to where you were before releasing that record. It's very,
especially at the moment where especially at the moment where any length of spell out of the releasing game is almost like starting from zero again.
Yeah.
You know, continuity is everything.
Yeah, I agree.
It really is. And what I've learned is that, and the landscape changes so rapidly at the moment, you know, from what was the pattern of play 3 months ago could be completely different now, because suddenly a playlist has been personalized and it's not editorial. Yeah. And, you know, there are so many different factors that change the landscape, and you're constantly having, like, we don't just review our own records. I analyze because there is a very large nerd in me. But, you know, I analyze other people's records. Who was the first to play them on radio?
Yeah.
What were the first playlists they had? You know, what was the trajectory of growth? Where did it stop? What made it kick on from what looked like a slowdown? You know, Radio 1 at the moment, it used to be getting 20 or 30 plays, specialist plays, to be in contention for the Radio 1 playlist.
Yeah.
It's now 50 to 70.
Yeah, I heard that the other day.
You know, Ben Kim's record, Don't You Want, what's it, Don't You Want, Somebody to Love.
Yeah.
72 plays before it had playlist consideration. You know, so... Yeah. That's a real mitigating factor as to suddenly how the landscape is changing, because they're being inundated with so much music, they're taking longer to see if it's standing the test of time, which in itself I understand, but you know, 72 players could be 4 months of which you've burnt out at Apple and Spotify by then.
Well, I think that's the thing. It's like the longevity is something that we talk about all the time, is the longevity of a record and how long do we work a record until we bin it off and move on to the next one. And it's kind of a tough, because I've heard it so many times with my friends and in the genre that I release in, is that it's like you've got 2 weeks to get any like hype or anything like that. And if you don't have any like tickles in those first 2 weeks, it's kind of on to the next, which is fucking depressing. If you think, I know we don't look at it like that. We're generally a month to 2 months, and we know roughly where we're at.
At a minimum, I always go under the adage, and so far, you know, the team are amazing at Good Company, because I always have to say that, because they're all, but again, it's that celebrating the small wins thing that I said earlier, where you're like, if there's any positivity, if you're up 2%, if you're, you know, if there's an increase in Shazams, if there's whatever, don't let it go. Keep working it. Because as a plugger from my past, you know, the one thing that made the difference to have a reputation about being a good plugger was just make sure that everyone is aware of it. And you if you've got a dodgy record, there's, the industry have got three types of records, right? They've got the records that make everyone look good.
Yeah.
And really, they've had very little involvement, and all the power is to the artist. And the A&R, the marketing, the promo are basically all just running behind that record, trying to keep up with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? But it showers everyone in this glorious light of success, whether or not it's huge commercial or critical, you know, club success, anything. It covers. Then there's the middle ground record where it's really good, but it needs to be worked.
Yeah.
And it could possibly get there. And then there's the records that doesn't matter what you say and how much you got it, you know, you read the signs and it's done.
Yeah.
You know, there aren't any positives. It isn't up. It isn't doing this. You're like, okay, you know, I'm not going to get anyone to play this. And that translates into the areas of what we do and label owners and stuff like that, where, you know, as a plugger back then, it's like, so long as everyone knew that you did your best and you got as many people to hear it and you worked it to the best of your ability, because otherwise, I don't necessarily agree with the 2 week adage where, because so much can change.
Totally.
You know, I'm not saying that lots don't disappear within 2 weeks. I'm aware that that might be the case, but, you know, it's that thing of, we've got a reputation of working records and doing as best as we can and doing the best for the record that we possibly can, as opposed to some other labels that have a much higher output than us that just chuck it out and wait for the record to react without necessarily working it. If it doesn't react, we move on. If it does, okay, chase it, you know. And even if our records don't react initially, we're like, right, What? Where else can we go? What else can we do? Where can we find some love? All right, okay, we're getting blanked in the UK. Let's try France. Let's try Germany. You know, let's try Holland.
Yeah.
Let's do this. Let's try and get some momentum going on.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it does prohibit how much you can put out, because there's only so much that can be the team's priority.
Totally. Yeah, yeah. No, that makes sense. With good, when you open Good Company and Get Together, what did you look at from a major label, from working in a major to then going to an independent? What were your things that you were like, I don't want to do what the majors do?
The main thing was speed of decision. Mm. You know, being decisive over things quite quickly, you know, trusting your gut again.
Yeah.
After having done this for so long, of like, do you know what? I don't want to, is it a great record? Yes, there's a little bit of thinking, I always have to think what the entry points for the record are.
Yeah.
Who's going to be the first person to play this at radio? Where, you know, how can we make it travel from that first play to anywhere else if it goes well? But the, you know, the process of approval and deliberation and questioning over something that with your knowledge and experience, which is all that you can rely on in this, yeah. You know, you believe in, not being subject to review. Mm. The majors do actually a lot of good things apart from
pivot,
having patience.
Okay.
You know, they do a lot of good things, but they're also stretched.
Yeah.
A lot of the people are working on other projects that aren't dance, and it's, you know, so the major systems, you know, the really good teams at majors have quite a self-contained unit of people working solely on dance music.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, whether or not that's three or four people, or, you know, ministry being 15 plus and that sort of thing, it's like, all we do is dance music, you know, and we understand that we're going to have to keep on pushing this for a bit. You know, like, because there were quite a lot of circumstances where, no, I kept on wanting to sign a record, and that signed a few records, you know, after a very lengthy process that were very cheap, that were really big hits.
Yeah.
They're like, fuck me, the ordeal that I had to go through to get that over the line, where I could easily have lost it somewhere else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
and then told you so doesn't wash.
Yeah. Do you find that? Everyone has totally. Do you find that in with Good Company, where have you ever got yourself into a bidding war with the majors? Because I know you guys don't spend the amount of money of what a major does, because your outlays are a lot lower.
Yeah, I mean, it's amazing. The pandemic, we suffered with a little, because our business model is like, this is collaborative.
Yeah.
If we win, we win together,
yeah, yeah.
Right? You get half the spoils, we get half the spoils. If it doesn't work, we got to take one on the chin.
Yeah.
But that's the name of the game, right? And there's an amazing amount of people, Fisher losing it being one, yeah. Offered stupid amounts of money for the record. Like, you're in first. I like what the deal is.
Yeah.
I like that I'm going to win. I'm going with you on this. And in the pandemic, when DJing fees disappeared, you know, understandably, DJs were like, I'm being offered 50 grand for this record. I've got to take it. And we'd get to the 11th hour.
Yeah.
And then suddenly they'd come in and it would be like, I've been offered 50 grand for this record. I'm like, I get it.
Yeah,
you know, take the money, man.
Yeah.
You know, do that. We've just got to be earlier. We're earlier. If it's unless, you know, 30, 40, 50 grand means not much to someone because of the fees that they're getting from a live situation. You know, if they're not earning hundreds and hundreds of thousands of pounds from their live, 50 grand makes a difference. Mm. So, you know, we've got to be in there earlier and take a few more risks, because even though it's a collaborative thing and we don't hand out an advance, there's still a fair amount of cost
totally.
To even putting out the club record.
Yeah,
let alone sure. when it starts getting some trajectory and you need to start putting more money into it to keep it going.
Mm. No, I totally agree. But I think also the difference between getting a record for 50 grand or 100 grand, your splits are way smaller as an artist. And like I've had countless of friends that have taken that payday, which sounds great at the time. But 50 grand, if it's not just a single deal, if it's a multiple single deal or an album deal, 250 grand, even 500 grand, it can kind of completely slow down your release schedule. You don't own half of your music. You don't, and the deal terms are ridiculous.
Yeah.
So there's the pros and cons, right? You would think that you sign to a major record label and you're going to have hit records because they're hit making places, but they're really not. To a certain extent. I mean,
not unless you're savvy. There's some people that I sort of say to when they're doing a deal and they're getting off at 100 grand, I'm like, ask for 50 and make them put the other 50 as a guaranteed commitment into marketing.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? Because the amazing thing is that they might sign a record for 100 grand, but then they'll put it out there in the same way that an indie would and see what it does without any, there are their own internal triggers to like, oh, it's doing this now. So yeah, we're going to put this amount of money, you know, it's doing that, you know, you're like, so it doesn't confirm or deny, but it definitely doesn't confirm success.
Yeah.
Want to stop you right there. Let this be an edit point because I am bursting for a wee.
Oh, mate, we don't need to edit that out. Let's wrap this motherfucker up. I thought you looked a bit uncomfortable. Yeah, it's fine. That's fine.
But I'm swiveling in my chair. Like,
yeah, I was like, Jesus Christ, he needs to piss, doesn't he? One last question. Yeah. One last question that I've started asking people at the end of the podcast. What is the one bit of life advice you would give somebody right now?
Go about your business with respect. Go about your business with, because this holds on to you. This, you know, this, if you can have these traits for yourself, right? And this might seem a bit airy fairy, but I honestly believe it sees you through. If you can go about your business with, you know, respect, a certain amount of loyalty, and I won't say trust because trusting everyone is quite naive, but you know, you've got to hold yourself to the standard that you expect of others.
Yeah.
Right. And if someone doesn't live up to that, then they ain't worth doing business with.
Mm.
Right. Because you've got to lead by example in these situations. And it's a business full of cowboys. It's a business full of, you know, chances, and you've got to be able to cut through all of that, you know, and have belief in what you do. You know, and you know, from a there are so many different things as a point of advice to give on technicality, on business, on, you know, if you're setting up a business, good lawyer, good accountant.
Yeah.
You know, it like is a must. Right. Otherwise, you're going to get shafted and you're going to owe the tax man a hell of a lot of money and you're never going to make another record again.
Yes.
Right. But unto yourself, it's like, I guess to summarize, you know, treat others how you expect to be treated, but it goes a long way. It's like it holds you in good stead because shit goes wrong all the time. Things don't work. Things that you thought were going to be a huge success end up being a failure. Things that you thought were okay end up being a huge success. But, you know, if you can carry through with you a sense of pride in who you are, how you go about business, and therefore also what you do, whether or not that's making music or PR or doing whatever, you know, it will see you through. Mm. It will help you rise above a lot of the bullshit that exists out here.
Love
and
that.
And there's a lot.
That's awesome. Thanks, mate. Go take a piss.
Absolute pleasure, man.
Thanks for coming on. How can people follow Good Company and how can people reach out to send you records?
info@goodcompany.co is the email. @alwaysbegoodcompany is the tags for Insta and everything else, you know. And between those two, we're always here.
Legend. Thanks, mate. Keep safe. See you soon.
Later, Big Willie.
Peace. See you in a bit. Ah, no, it's a wrap. Love that conversation. I feel like we could have gone on forever, but we actually have a meeting in half an hour with the label crew. So had to wrap it up and he needed a piss. So big ups to everybody for listening. Speak to you very soon. Till next time.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.